And they're off. This week's news stories are racing, racing, racing to get noticed in the news cycle by the end of the week. It's the swine flu. Check that. It's H1N1 with its new name out in front. But the death of the car industry is making a strong run on the outside. Supreme Court Justice David Souter is gaining on the inside rail, and no one has seen Pakistan or Afghanistan at all since the first turn. It's the home stretch, and look, here comes Souter's retirement. He's edging for the wire. The Kentucky Derby is tomorrow, but we're watching which news story is making the run for the roses. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, May 1st. I'm Todd Zwillick. John Hockenberry is away.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Daljit Dhaliwal. Hello, Todd. Now, coming up this hour, changes afoot in the Supreme Court. There's going to be a switcheroo. It is being widely reported that Justice David Souter is reportedly going to be stepping down. We'll also talk about the best name for the swine flu virus, or should we say H1N1. And as we just heard a little while ago, Todd was talking about the Kentucky Derby, which is taking place tomorrow. We will be tracking that for you. Get your big hats and mint juleps ready. Those stories are coming up in a minute. But first, let's get a check of the headlines.
Today begins a five-day shutdown in Mexico to stop the spread of H1N1, the swine flu. Mexico City resident Marcela Serrato, says you can't miss the government health warnings.
It's everywhere. On the TV, on the internet, on the phones, and everywhere. Everywhere except in the park. In the park, people are still running without face masks.
All right, that's in Mexico. Here in the U.S., there could be a shakeup on the Supreme Court. It's widely reported today that Justice David Souter will step down in June. He hasn't been shy about his distaste for Washington politics in the nearly 19 years that he's been on the bench.
Chrysler heads to bankruptcy court today for its first hearing. Its CEO, Bob Nardelli, says that bankruptcy was the only way to save the company.
It is the most viable path now to make sure that Chrysler survives, and the people whose livelihoods depend on Chrysler surviving get that chance.
And officials are hoping that the bankruptcy case will be short and sweet, maybe taking only around perhaps 2 months. But those Chrysler creditors who turned down a Treasury deal will also get to present their cases in court as well.
Back in the U.S., the Kentucky Derby bell goes off tomorrow afternoon. I Want Revenge is the favored filly in the race. On Wall Street, the Dow and S&P were flat yesterday. The Dow opens at 8168, and the S&P starts trading at 873. Well, it's being widely reported that Justice David Souter is planning to retire from the Supreme Court in June after more than 18 years on the court. And we want to know, who do you think President Obama should name to take his place? It doesn't have to be a big-time lawyer. It doesn't have to be a circuit court judge. We want to know who you think belongs on the court, who will represent your views, and whom you respect enough to have on the Supreme Court.
Somebody actually said Springer, didn't they?
Somebody said Jerry Springer.
Jerry Springer.
Well, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and let us know. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Somebody said Jerry Springer. Somebody else said Diana Ross of the Supremes.
Yes, that was Femi.
We want to know who came in with some music. And we want to know what you think.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Hi, good morning, everybody. I'm Todd Zwillick. I'm here with Daljit Dhaliwal. John Hockenberry's away, but Justice David Souter, it's been widely reported, has told the White House that he will retire from the Supreme Court at the end of the court's term this June. Souter's retirement, of course, gives President Obama his very first pick for the high court, and that is a great big deal in Washington, D.C. and throughout the country. We're joined now by Adam Liptak, the Supreme Court correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Adam, is it a surprise to you that Souter was the first to go from this court?
If someone was going to go, it was likely to be Souter. There were a couple justices who are older who have had some health issues, but Souter was widely known to be itching to get out of Washington. He doesn't like the town.
Right.
He does like his home in New Hampshire. And in some ways, he didn't seem to like the work of the court. He said not too long ago that when the court's term starts in October, he undergoes an intellectual lobotomy. He has to read briefs. He likes to read books. And the truth is that the work of the court is hard, and it's a grind, and he took it seriously, and he worked awfully hard. But he didn't love it, and he also didn't love official Washington or even probably the power and status that came with being on the court.
He prefers his small cabin up there in the woods of New Hampshire,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. Souter might be one out of the nine on the court that was the least known or among the least known. What is he known for on the court? What role did he play, would you say?
Well, he was certainly a member of the court's liberal wing. He was also, judging from his questioning on the bench, a very smart and serious old-school judge who looked at each case one at a time, didn't come to it with a particular ideological cast, although in the end his votes tended to go on the liberal side. And he asked especially penetrating questions and was perhaps the only justice on the court who would routinely get some piece of information from a judge, from an advocate, that might change the direction he was going in. He was the only guy who would say, oh, I see, I stand corrected.
Who would actually acknowledge that somebody could change his thinking on something.
Exactly. So he wasn't scoring points from the bench. He was actually trying to shape his thinking and trying to elicit information.
All right. Well, Adam, listen to this piece of sound that I want to play. It's a piece of sound from a Supreme Court argument that most people, even if they don't follow the court, they'll probably recognize what Souter's talking about.
There is no genuinely subjective indication beyond what can be viewed as either a dimple or a hanging chad. And there is a general rule being applied in a given county that an objective intent or an intent on an objective standard will be inferred. And that objective rule varies, we're told, from county to county.
All right, so a bit of legalese and sort of Supreme Court language there, but that's Bush v. Gore.
Right, and a couple things. One thing you'll notice there is that although that was complicated, that sentence, if you parsed it out grammatically, would work, which is not easy to do in that kind of context at that length. More importantly, that was probably the case that soured Justice Souter on the court, as Jeffrey Toobin reported in his very good book, The Nine. He took the court's decision in that very seriously and very negatively. Toobin reported that he still thinks about Bush v. Gore and cries about it. Hmm. It was a real turning point for him. I think it was a shock that members of the court used arguments and doctrines to reach a result that might have suited them politically, but which they'd never adhered to before in other kinds of cases.
All right, so the obvious next step in this is naming a replacement, and we have to get into that because it's not like Washington doesn't have enough to do this
right.
Summer with the climate change debates, healthcare, everything else that's going to be going on in the Senate. But before we get to that, real quickly, we have to talk about possible replacements. I mean, Souter, like you said, is generally a liberal. Everyone would expect President Obama to appoint someone who's probably ideologically similar, but what names are out there and what demographics of a replacement are we looking at?
And let me start by saying there are names out there, and I'm going to list them for you, but I don't think anybody really knows anything, and I'm not sure the White House has gone very far down this road. So people throw names around, but that doesn't mean that these are the only or best names in the mix. The conventional wisdom is that Obama is going to name a second woman to the court.
Mm-hmm.
So that narrows the demographics down immediately by half. The names you often hear are the new Solicitor General, Elena Kagan, until recently Dean of the Harvard Law School, and a couple of federal appeals court judges, Sonia Sotomayor in New York and Diane Wood in Chicago. But again, there's a kind of echo chamber effect to this, and I'm not sure I would take any of this to the bank, and I'm not sure that the White House has much started the process of winnowing down whom it wants to appoint.
Yeah, and again, it's not like they don't have enough to do. President Obama
right.
said in his news conference Wednesday night, we expected two things. We've got seven or eight, and I can't worry about immigration reform because I've got enough to do. Well, guess what? He's got even more to do
yeah.
now, doesn't he?
And what we've seen so far from his very limited appointments to the lower court is that he is probably more in the mold of Clinton, who was appointing moderate liberals to the court, like Justices Ginsburg and Breyer. So you have a couple factors here. It's a liberal for liberal replacement. It won't change the fundamental dynamics of the court.
Right.
You have a president who may not be thinking about appointing a big liberal voice like Brennan or Marshall or Warren. And you have a Senate which is heavily dominated and may soon be filibuster-proof by Democrats. Right. So it might not be, it'll be a big moment, but it might not be as big a fight as we've seen in some previous years.
Maybe not as big of a fight as like a Bork or an Alito or even a Roberts. However, I cover the Senate, and everybody around there knows that judicial nominations, especially Supreme Court, whether you really oppose the nominee because of the nominee or not, it is a wonderful opportunity to establish and reinforce your party ideology. Mm-hmm. And even more than that, a great opportunity to raise money because
right.
Especially on the Republican, on the conservative side and on the liberal side, too, they give a lot of money around supporting these nominees. So it could be pretty dynamic, right?
Right. And it also, and you know, from my perspective covering the court, it also is a rare moment where it focuses the nation's attention on an institution they don't always pay a lot of attention to, and starts a kind of national dialogue about what it is we want from the court and what it is we want from a justice, and that's not a bad thing either.
All right, well, I got to ask you about Arlen Specter real quick, because he's been in the news this week. Obviously, he plans to switch his party affiliation from Republican to Democrat, former chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and has been right at the center of the Supreme Court fight since the beginning of his Senate career. Does the fact that he's switching mean anything in terms of that 60 number that you mentioned, or is he likely to be an independent voice on this?
It's a little hard to predict
Right.
Specter at the best of times, and he's at this moment of change. I think, in a way, the more interesting question is who becomes the ranking Republican member, and how does that change the dynamics of the questioning? Because Specter, say what you want about him, is a sophisticated lawyer, and ran the last several confirmation hearing, ran the Roberts confirmation hearing, with real attention to interesting legal issues.
Adam, it's Daljit Dhaliwal here. Hello.
Yes.
Outside of the Beltway, how big a deal is Suit? I mean, do people really know who he is? Do they care outside of Washington, D.C.?
I think that the candid answer to that has to be no and no. People know a couple of Supreme Court justices. They know about Clarence Thomas and maybe Antonin Scalia, and they knew and loved Sandra Day O'Connor. But once you get past that list, the Supreme Court justices are not well known, and even if the name is recognized, people will be hard pressed to say much about that person.
Is it because he just doesn't stand out? I mean, compared to the others,
he doesn't make public appearances. He hasn't written a book. He's not interested in that kind of quasi-celebrity life. It's just not his style. At the same time, there's this caricature of him, which is quite inaccurate, that he's some kind of eccentric hermit, whereas he's a lovely man with lots of good friends who likes to enjoy ordinary, rich intellectual life in a way that is completely at odds with official Washington.
All right, so we're real quickly, Adam, just before we get to the end, is it too early to know what cases are percolating in the circuits that will be a factor next year that the new justice and the Senate that names the new justice will probably be contending with?
Yeah, the short answer, it's not too early to tell what might be coming up, but what's in the pipeline these days doesn't look very interesting.
Oh, really? Short answer. Nothing, but something could get filed on detainees. Maybe Guantanamo is not quite settled, or is it?
There are a couple of cases out of the D.C. Circuit. One involving Guantanamo. One involving detainees held at Bagram. So yes, those issues will continue to hit the court. But it does seem that. The Obama administration is trying to find ways not to have fights over those issues in the Supreme Court, as we saw with the enemy combatant case, which they short-circuited rather than have the court decide.
All right. Adam Liptak, Supreme Court correspondent for The New York Times, talking about David Souter. Thanks for joining us. David Souter, widely reported, announced that he is leaving the court at the end of the term. We want to know. There's a new opening. Who would you name for the Supreme Court? Call us and let us know, 8778-MY-TAKE. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
The Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
All right. Good morning, everyone. I'm Todd Zwillick. Daljeet Dhaliwal is sitting across from me. It's being widely reported, of course, that Supreme Court Justice David Souter is planning to retire in June after more than 18 years on the court. And we want to know who you think President Obama should nominate to take his place.
Hi, my name is Mary Gillespie, and I'm from Salt Lake City, Utah, and I recommend Rocky Anderson.
Makes sense. He happens to be the former mayor of Salt Lake City. Well, call us at 877-8-MYTAKE. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Let us know who you think should be on the court. What's your opinion? Daljeet?
Yeah, we've had some interesting responses, haven't we?
We have.
So Chrysler is in court this morning filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy as the company sorts out its fate. It hopes that a judge will allow it to carry on paying its vendors, its lawyers, and of course its workers. It is a last-ditch effort at reorganization as it operates on a multi-billion dollar lifeline from the government. And joining us to look at the restructuring and Chrysler's plans to link it up with Fiat is Rebecca Lindland from Global Insight, a financial forecasting company, and Robert Farrago, a blogger for The Truth About Cars. Welcome to both of you this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me start with you first of all, Rebecca. What will life be like under Fiat?
Well, Fiat doesn't necessarily have controlling interest in Chrysler. Chrysler is actually controlled by the union now. So, in terms of majority stakeholders, so it will be. This is a joint venture to help provide Chrysler with small cars that they really need more because of federal regulations than because of consumer demand.
Robert, let me bring you in here. What was this? Do you think the only option for Chrysler?
Absolutely. They took in less money than they spent for over a decade. They were a zombie automaker before they filed, and they're still a zombie automaker now. The Fiat plan is frankly not credible for them going forward, and I don't look for them to continue much further than 120 days from now. I can't see them not.
Why do you think it's not credible? Is there nothing in the deal that makes this a viable merger?
No, there's nothing there. It takes at least 2 years to start building a new product, a new automobile. And frankly, the American taxpayer is not going to put in the money that's needed for that. Remember, we've put in $4 billion, another $8 billion is coming. It would take another $8, $10, $15 billion to achieve this plan. And frankly, I don't think the American taxpayer is going to put up with it. Or even if it comes to that, because there are so many creditors, so many people trying to get a piece of this, that it just may fall apart in bankruptcy court.
Rebecca, what do you think? Do you think it's likely to go through? Is it going to be a surgical procedure? Is it going to be straightforward and simple? Or could there be complications that turn up at the bankruptcy court for Fiat and this merger?
Well, you know, I've been comparing this idea of a surgical bankruptcy to actual surgery. And when you go under the knife and under anesthesia, there's always complications. And the longer the surgery lasts, the less likely the patient's going to survive. And the same thing can be said about this bankruptcy idea. We've never in modern times had an auto manufacturer come out of bankruptcy successfully. And I know that there's all these prepackaged agreements and all these, you know, I mean, Obama needed to stay positive yesterday. He needed to make the consumer believe that this is no big deal. But we're already starting to hear that the idea that they're going to come out in 30 or 60 or even 90 days isn't realistic. And as long as bankruptcy continues, the longer it goes on, the less likely Chrysler's going to survive.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of what President Obama had to say about that.
I stand with Chrysler's employees and their families and communities. I stand with Chrysler's management, its dealers, and its suppliers. I stand with the millions of Americans who own and want to buy Chrysler cars. I don't stand with those who held out when everybody else is making sacrifices.
Robert, what do you think about what the president had to say?
Well, he's trying to lay the blame on the hedge funds. The blame for Chrysler's problems lays straight with their management and the products that they created. The president would like everyone to believe that the evil bankers are responsible for this situation, and nothing could be further from the truth.
Well, he was very explicit about it, wasn't he?
Well, he had to blame somebody, and he blamed them. That's the sort of meme that's going around nowadays, is that Detroit's problems are not Detroit's problems, but the problems of either the economy or the evil bankers who seek to recover money that they don't deserve or that not make sacrifices that they should.
Rebecca, do you see it that way? Are these evil hedge fund guys, are they to blame? Did they want more than they were prepared to put out? They wanted to take a lot more back?
No, I think that what the quote-unquote evil hedge fund people really wanted was just their legal entitlement, which was that they were going to be in first position in terms of recouping any losses should this deal go bad. And the other issue that they had, particularly the three hedge funds that held out, was that they had issues with the amount of equity that the UAW was receiving in the Chrysler Corporation. So they basically feel like, you know what, we're going to go ahead and go into bankruptcy court. We're going to go before a bankruptcy judge and let him decide instead of being pushed from a political standpoint into agreeing to basically 33 cents on the dollar.
Okay, Robert, very briefly, how hard do you think it's going to be to change American buying habits over the long term?
You mean change them towards buying a Chrysler stroke Fiat product?
Absolutely.
I think it's impossible. It's a damaged brand. I don't think it would take 10. It took Cadillac 10 years to come back from where it was. It would take at least that long for Chrysler to come back. I don't think they can do it. They don't have the culture, the technology. Now that they've taken all this bankruptcy money, there's a lot of people, all the subsidy, there are a lot of people who won't buy Chryslers for that reason. They're not great cars either. I don't think they can possibly come back. This is a huge waste of money.
And that was Robert Farago, a blogger for the truthaboutcars.com, and Rebecca Lindland from Global Insight. Thank you very much for joining us.
Femi is here with headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. There could soon be signs that there could be a new justice at the Supreme Court. Reports saying this morning that Supreme Court Justice David Souter is ready to call it quits. Justices usually bow out when they're very old or very sick. Now, compared to his colleague, Souter is very young and healthy, but said to be weary of Washington. The first President Bush appointed him. The head of the CDC says that there is no increased risk of swine flu for people using public transportation. Dr. Richard Besser from the CDC said that this morning on NBC's Today program, following Vice President Joe Biden's statement yesterday saying that he wouldn't recommend people taking buses or going on the subway or even going in airplanes. And Besser said that he called that moment a teachable moment. Mexico's top disease scientist says that the World Health Organization was slow on the draw with the H1N1 or swine flu. He says that the WHO was late in responding to Mexico's mid-April warning of an outbreak. And the WHO says that it moved quickly once labs in the US and Canada identified the new flu strain. And that's the look at stories making headlines this morning. Todd Dowjett.
Thank you.
Joe Biden with a teachable moment.
And he gives us so many.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
Nobody messes with Joe.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Todd Zwillick. Daljeet Dhaliwal is here with me. It's been widely reported, of course, that Supreme Court Justice David Souter is planning to retire in June after more than 18 years on the Supreme Court. And we want to know, who do you think President Obama should nominate to take his place? One listener thinks fictional characters might be our best bet.
Denny Crane from Crane, Poole & Schmidt.
from the show Boston Legal, William Shatner. In addition to being a great lawyer, he's also a starship captain and has got his eye on the future. And as T.J. Hooker, was a law enforcement personnel.
I got bad news for you, buddy. William Shatner is Canadian. Although I do agree he'd be a great choice. He went to my alma mater, McGill University in Montreal. That is a Canadian gentleman. I don't think he's eligible unless he becomes a citizen. Anyway, call us at 8778-MYTAKE. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Let us know who you think should be on the court. Canadians, Americans, Mexicans, Kenyans. It doesn't matter. It's your choice, Daljit.
Jerry Springer was one of them, right? Yep. So just to be clear, we are not, and I repeat, we are not in a pandemic, but we seem to have had an outbreak of that word.
The United States is, quote, proceeding as if we are preparatory to a full pandemic.
When you talk about things like this, you talk about a pandemic.
Calling this a pandemic.
A pandemic is imminent.
Potential for development into a pandemic.
And there's also a lot of discussion about what we should be calling the flu virus. The World Health Organization says no more swine flu after it reportedly came under pressure from the meat industry. They'll be calling it influenza H1N1. Doesn't quite roll off the tongue like swine flu. With us is Grant Barrett, a lexicographer. That doesn't quite roll off the tongue either. But you are the co-host of the public radio show Away With Words. And thank you very much for being with us this morning.
My pleasure.
How difficult, Grant, do you think it's going to be to dislodge the word swine flu from people's minds? Is it going to be very difficult to get them to start calling it influenza AH1N1, to use its correct scientific name?
That's impossible. Don't think of pink elephants, right? It's done already. It's out. The box has been opened. The word is out there. You might call it the H1N1. Even that short version is too difficult to say.
So what is it? Is it just that people like the idea of calling it swine flu? It rolls off the tongue, and it has these sort of certain connotations with hogs, which aren't entirely accurate either. So, you know, if we want to be accurate about what we want to call it, we should call it by its correct name. So why is it so problematic for people?
I think it's fixed because that's where it started. We started with this minor panic about the swine flu. It's now lodged in our brains in this panicky place. It's got a bright red flag attached to it. And to say that, well, that's no longer a problem, you just can't wash that away with words. You have to wash it away with action. Will the deaths decrease? Then maybe the word will decrease as well.
So no hogwash.
No.
So why do you think that some words, though, have stickiness and others don't?
Swine flu is actually kind of memorable. It's easy to say. It takes two words that we all know. It works really well in the mouth. That is, it's not difficult for the tongue and the lips to utter. Something like the 2009 H1N1 virus, or whatever the variations are that they're calling it, that doesn't have any of those characteristics.
You deal with words, you know, in your everyday life. You deal with them in your work as well. How do new words actually get created, and what does it take to replace an existing one? How do you sort of, like, you know, get it out of one's consciousness?
The words that succeed are the words that are useful, and actually they're usually not very clever. They're words that just are really ordinary. They're common. They're even flat and boring. And the charming stuff, or the stuff that you joke at when you read it in the newspaper, that stuff just doesn't work very well at all.
Okay, so that means that we don't have to come up with anything sexy for hand washing, right? Because we talk about pandemic and swine flu, and those words, if not panic, they incite a lot of concern. Pandemic is a big, big, scary word. Mm-hmm. The simple word and the simple solution, and I've been harping on it, I know, is hand washing. Wash your hands. That's one of those things that's straightforward. We don't need to come up with some kind of snazzy disco word.
Manual lavation or something like that. No, right. nothing like that at all. Though, you know, you can actually take the H1N1 word and you can do things to it. I've seen people say, well, it looks kind of like a leet speak word, you know, this online language where people take letters and replace them with numbers. So H1N1 looks kind of like the word hiney. So you might call it the hiney virus.
That's something that we can,
I like that,
chomp on.
I think we've got a new word on the takeaway.
Yeah, let's just make up words on the takeaway. But talking of replacing words, but where the meaning stays the same, this isn't really true of pandemic, right? At least not in the English language.
No.
There is no other word for it.
No, and it's because the word serves its role perfectly in all of the Romance languages. Actually, as a matter of fact, in all of the languages in Europe, they use a form of the word pandemic. because and there's no really good synonym for this. Now, we have words that describe, say, an affliction specifically for cattle that's widespread and is dangerous, or for pigs, or for plants.
That's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it, that first one?
Well, the word epizootic. Actually, it's kind of fun to say. Epizootic.
It is.
Epizootic is a word that describes an affliction usually of cattle or pigs that... very much like this.
All animals, if it's if it's infectious.
Mm-hmm, that's right. And for plants, there's a word, epiphytotic.
What defines a pandemic?
It is a matter of geography, not of severity.
So it's to do with its geographical reach.
That's right.
It's nothing to do with how severe it becomes in a particular country or fixed geographical location.
And this is a mistake that I hear people make repeatedly, both in public and in the media. Epidemic isn't necessarily fewer deaths. It could be more deaths. It's just a smaller contained region.
And pandemic has nothing to do with panic, because it sometimes is that association in people's minds as well.
But no. It's closer, in fact, to the word pandemonium. So if you want to
Oh, good. Well, much more comforting.
But no, pandemic is actually just a mix of the word pan from Greek, which means all, endemic, which means people, all the people. All the people get it.
So so that's where it started?
I mean,
it
goes all the way back to Greek.
And what other memorable pandemics come to mind? I mean, not just in terms of the influenza, but other viruses.
Well, of course we can talk about the plague, right? Actually, in the history of humanity, we've always been afflicted with these kinds of things. And certainly we've always been we've associated these with our livestock as well. If you do reading on the history of Ireland, for example, there's something called the Great Murrain. It's Murrain. And this was a time when 9 out of 10 cattle just died. They keeled over from a great pandemic among the cattle.
And that was Grant Barrett. Thank you very much for coming here to speak with us. Grant Barrett is a lexicographer and a co-host of the public radio show Away With Words. You've got Away With Words, haven't you, Femi?
I like Grant. He'd be a great person to go for a drink with, wouldn't he? He'd have all these great stories about
words. He would,
words,
wouldn't he?
Stories.
Lots of interesting things
all
to
right,
say about
20
words.
Minutes to the top of the hour. Today, a court will deal with Chrysler's bankruptcy. The troubled automaker hopes that its new Chapter 11 filing will change its fortunes. The White House backs the plan, saying that it will save more than 30,000 jobs at Chrysler alone. It's an unexpected holiday for students in nearly 300 American schools, but the day off comes under the dark cloud of H1N1 or swine flu. School officials have shut down classes, hoping to block further spread of the disease. In international news, 10 Pakistani security officials apparently kidnapped by Taliban militants are now free. The men were taken in the country's volatile northwest, which is a hotbed for militant activity. And that's a look at your big news stories for now.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Daljit Dhaliwal.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. This Saturday is the 135th running of the Kentucky Derby, and if you're like me and like Daljit and you don't know anything about the Kentucky Derby or horse racing in general, except women wearing big floppy hats and drinking mint juleps, I guess, then listen up. We're about to let you in on all you need to know about this year's Run for the Roses. Jenny Reese is a reporter for the Courier-Journal. She's covered horse racing for over 25 years, and she joins us this morning from the backside of Churchill Downs. Jenny, big floppy hats, how many do you see out there?
Well, I'm on the backside, so I see a lot of baseball caps.
Oh.
The floppy hats are on the front side. Although, actually, there are some well-dressed people, and they're kind of tiptoeing around the mud here. We have had a lot of rain this week, and the forecast is for intermittent showers and thunderstorms.
Oh, so we might have a sloppy track.
Might have a sloppy track. And the interesting thing about that is 14 of the 20 horses in the field have never raced on a sloppy track. So adds just another wrinkle to trying to handicap.
And does that do anything to the odds, I was going to ask?
It could. The fourth choice is a horse named Frisian Fire that won the Louisiana Derby on a sloppy track. And I would expect him to get bet pretty heavily because he's one of two horses in the field who have won on a sloppy track.
Okay.
If he's the fourth choice, he could be the favorite.
He could be the favorite. And I heard that there's another horse in the field, Mr. Hot Stuff, is that right? What about Mr. Hot Stuff?
Oh, yes. We saw Mr. Hot Stuff train, and they all have Mr. Hot Stuff T-shirts, and Mr. Hot Stuff is named for the owner's son-in-law. And he does look hot indeed.
All right. Well, what do the jockeys look like this year? The horses get all the attention.
They look short.
Really?
Are they hot? Aren't they hot?
Are there any jockeys named Mr. Hot Stuff?
Not publicly. I'd have to maybe ask their significant others about that.
All right. So what are the proper parameters, weight-wise, height-wise, and otherwise for a jockey?
Well, there's no height parameter, but because you have to probably can't weigh much more than 116 pounds, you know, you're not going to be too tall, for sure. But the horses carry in the Kentucky Derby 126 pounds, which is, compared to a normal race, pretty high. So a lot of these jockeys can probably actually maybe eat breakfast today. There's only been one case where a jockey has been overweight. A guy actually from Louisville named Bobby Parrott, this was some years ago, and he was a half pound overweight, and it went down in the history books as him carrying 126 and a half pounds, and it was known forever as the fat jockey.
The fat jockey.
I wish I could be 126 pounds.
And people can call me fat all day long if I weighed 126 and a half. Well, all right, well, back to the horses. These are all colts. No fillies in the Kentucky Derby,
not
is that correct?
Not this year. They could be. They're just not any this year, and there is a filly that's heavily favored in the Kentucky Oaks this afternoon, Rachel Alexander, that a lot of people thought would be very tough if she was in the Oaks. But one thing you said you need to, if you want to know about horses, and if you're going to go to a party or something, as far as the Kentucky Derby, do not ask, have any of these horses ever been in the Derby before? Because you have to be 3 years old. You could be male or female, but you have to be 3 years old to race in the Kentucky Derby.
So you must be three. So if you ask that question, you will betray the fact that you don't know a darn thing about the Kentucky Derby.
Absolutely.
All right.
Well, I
want to ask you real quick. I mentioned mint juleps before and that people were drinking them. A friend of mine who is from Kentucky told me that that's a myth, that people at the Derby don't actually drink bourbon with their mint juleps. Is that true?
No, people do drink mint juleps, just not the locals.
Just not the locals. They don't want to waste the bourbon. Right.
Absolutely. Well, they think it's a big waste of bourbon, and they know that you can just go to the drugstore, the grocery store, and for $2.50 buy one of the souvenir glasses.
All right, Jenny Reese.
$12.
All right, Jenny, thanks. We got a wrap. She's a reporter for the Courier Journal. She covers horse racing. Thanks for educating us on the Derby, Jenny.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Todd Zwillick. Daljit Dhaliwal is here with me. It's being widely reported that Supreme Court Justice David Souter is stepping down. He's planning to step down in June after more than 18 years on the court. And we want to know, who do you think President Obama should nominate to take his place? One listener thinks we should add Jerry Springer.
Hi, this is Jack from Las Vegas, and I would nominate Jerry Springer. He has real-world experience and a law degree.
All right, so does that mean you want the Supreme Court oral arguments to sound like this?
Thank you. Hey, welcome to the show today. We are talking to people who have had their lovers stolen by a skanky slut.
Yeah. Or should they sound instead like this?
Why shouldn't there be one objective rule for all counties? And if there isn't, why isn't it an equal protection violation?
All right, Supreme Court might be better if there were some insults or chairs thrown between Souter and Scalia. I wonder what would happen if Jerry Springer was added into the mix. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Femi is here with headlines.
At 12 minutes to the top of the hour, with not a skank in sight. The U.S. State Department has issued its yearly assessment of global terrorism, and Iran is once again listed as a state sponsor of terror. But Iranian officials are protesting, and the designation could make President Obama's diplomatic overtures to Iran more challenging. In Iraq, three American servicemen were killed west of Baghdad yesterday. Military officials say that two Marines and a sailor died in combat, and that brings the April death toll for American servicemen in Iraq to 18, making April the deadliest month this year for American servicemen in Iraq. And as you heard from Todd just a few moments ago, there are reports out this morning that Supreme Court Justice David Souter is stepping down in June. Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz says that Justice David Souter's departure was expected.
Justice Souter has told many friends that he was anxious to get back to his roots in New England, and that he would retire relatively young from the Supreme Court.
Justice Souter was appointed by the first President Bush, but faced pressure not to step down while President George W. Bush was in office. And Souter is 69, and that's pretty much a spring chicken in Supreme Court years. Staying in Washington, it has passed the House, and now a bill that limits how credit card companies can raise rates goes before the Senate. President Obama backs the bill, and it is expected to pass in the Senate, but banking officials say that it is too restrictive. As a look at big stories making headlines this morning, Todd.
Thank you, Femi. Well, down in Texas, there have been unexpected vacation this week for thousands of school kids, also for thousands more across the country because of concerns about the H1N1 virus, also known as swine flu. In Fort Worth, Texas, all 144 schools were closed because of one single suspected case. Hundreds of other schools are closed nationwide. And as the number of confirmed cases in this country continues to go up, precautions and reactions and overreactions have begun to affect everyone's lives, even in places where there hasn't been a single case of H1N1 found. We're joined by Monica Davey now. She's the Chicago Bureau Chief for our partner, the New York Times, and by Clint Bond, spokesperson for the Fort Worth Independent School District. Mr. Bond, let me start with you. You're the spokesperson down in Fort Worth. You've got about 80,000 students in the Fort Worth Independent School District there. Walk us through the decision to close the schools.
It was an agonizing decision that was not made in a vacuum. It was made in concert with the public health officials of our local county, as well as consultation with state health officials and the state education commissioner. And it was a day-long process that we made on Wednesday. And initially, our plans were to close four schools, but then the information that the health department received, they recommended that we close the entire school district. And when we did close, we had one probable case, and then we had three suspected cases. That has since risen to one confirmed case and seven probable cases.
And can you give us just real quickly a readout of that day-long meeting with you, your bosses, the superintendents, I'm sure the school board, maybe the public health officials? Give us a readout of what that meeting was like, pros versus cons, advantages versus disadvantages of closing the schools.
Well, obviously, the biggest disadvantage is we're in the business of educating children. And if you close a school district, then you're not educating children, you're not accomplishing your mission. So that's the biggest disadvantage and the biggest con. The pros, obviously, are that the safety of the children is our top concern. So whether we close a school, whether we just close the doors to a school and keep the kids inside, I mean, safety is paramount. So those were the two items that the superintendent, who ultimately is responsible for this decision, that she had to weigh. Again, she didn't do it alone. Tarrant County Health Department stood right there next to her. She consulted with the state officials. She consulted with her local school board. And she took all of the facts from her cabinet and decided that that was the best course of action for everyone involved.
All right, Monica Davey from the New York Times there in Chicago. Let me bring you in. You and your colleagues have a great story in the New York Times this morning, and you and your colleagues interviewed people from all across the country, from New York to San Francisco. What are you seeing? Near panic, near apathy, all of the above?
It really is all of the above. You have people out there who really this isn't affecting their lives one bit, and they're sort of mocking almost of the people who are feeling most upset about this. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you've got people who are, you know, buying up all the surgical face masks and who are busy making decisions about whether to keep their children out of daycare, out of schools. And we're talking about schools that have no cases so far. So these are the types of things. I mean, really, people are making little decisions. Do I touch the elevator buttons?
So based on what you've gleaned from your interviews all across the country and what you heard Mr. Bond from down there in Fort Worth talk about, what would people glean from the closing of a school with only a couple of cases? Certainly a public health advantage, certainly a disadvantage because you have to educate kids. Does that push people's meter to the panic end of things, that they better start duct taping the windows? How do people react to it?
Well, we did talk to some people down in Fort Worth, some parents down there. It's, again, it's a huge range of reactions. You've got the people who say, well, that seems over the top. It seems silly to be keeping our kids out of school and thus keeping us out of work. And then on the other hand, you have people who say, well, better safe than sorry, and for whom this actually makes them a little more jumpy about the whole thing. They're thinking that maybe it's not safe to be walking around in Fort Worth. Mm-hmm. You don't know what to do exactly.
All right. Well, Mr. Bond, I want to ask you about the rationale for the date. It's May 11th, right, that you're set to reopen. Is that correct?
Well, it's through May 8th when we're closed. We're unsure at the moment if activities may resume over that ensuing weekend, but certainly school, we're planning on it resuming on May 11th.
Okay, so that's basically a week off. Was there some kind of public health imperative that they said a week would be sort of fitting with the what they know about the activity of flu viruses, or was it just kind of a convenient week off school that you chose?
No, it was in concert again with the public health officials. That was their recommendation for the duration of this hiatus. And we are educators. We're not health officials, so we're taking their expert advice.
All right, Monica, what's your takeaway on this? How do you think – I know you said that reactions range from near panic to near apathy. Do you get an overall sense of how people are handling this, even if they're upset about it and taking their kids out of daycare? Do we have any sense that people's lives are really being affected? They might get on the phone and make two calls about daycare, and that's it for the day. Or is it taking over their lives in any sense?
I think that it depends where you are. If you're in a place where they've found a probable or confirmed case, I was surprised at just how obsessive people can be over this. It when you start talking about it affecting someone you knew in your school or in your workplace, then suddenly it seems to be a little more overwhelming to people.
All right. My guest, Monica Davey, Chicago bureau chief for The New York Times, has a great story interviewing people about their reactions to H1N1. And thanks, Clint Bond, spokesperson for the Fort Worth Independent School District, who closed 144 schools in response to the H1N1 outbreak. Daljit.
It's been widely reported that Supreme Justice David Souter is planning to retire in June after more than 18 years at the court. We want to know, who do you think President Obama should nominate to take his place?
Hello, this is Don Vito Corleone of New York. I'd like to nominate myself for the Supreme Court Justice so I could sit with my paisan Anton Scalia and all the conservatives. God bless America.
I love it, the Godfather hit. Try this one out.
My name is Shirley Cushy, and I'm calling from Manhattan, and I think Elliot Spitzer would be the best candidate to replace. I think he'd bring some spice into the Supreme Court.
All right, tell us your pick at 8778MYTAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org and your takeaway about Justice Souter on the court.
He asked especially penetrating questions and was perhaps the only justice on the court who would routinely get some piece of information from an advocate that might change the direction he was going in. He was the only guy who would say, oh, I see, I stand corrected.
That's Adam Liptak from The Times. I'm Todd Zwillick.
I'm Daljit Dhaliwal.
It's The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Just this week, former Republican Senator Arlen Specter said these words.
I will not be an automatic 60th vote.
Well, suddenly, the newly minted Democrat from Pennsylvania is sounding prophetic. Now the former Judiciary Chairman will have a crucial say on who will be the 106th Justice on the Supreme Court. We're looking at the politics of the court today on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, May 1st. I'm Todd Zwillick. John Hockenberry is away.
Good morning, Todd. Good morning, everyone. I'm Daljit Dhaliwal. Welcome to the program. Coming up, is Fiat the big winner in the Chrysler crash? Why painting your roof white may be the new green? And there's news this morning of a likely shake-up on the Supreme Court. What happens to that carefully crafted court balance if Justice Souter steps down, as is being widely reported this morning? Those stories coming up in just a moment. But first, the headlines.
The head of the CDC says it's safe to travel despite the swine flu outbreak. Acting Director Richard Besser told CBS News, there is no increased risk of infection for people who use public transportation.
Travel is not recommended for people who have the flu. The rest of the population is free to travel, and I think that's quite safe.
Now, Besser has advised against non-essential travel to Mexico, though he was responding to questions about Vice President Joe Biden's statements that he wouldn't recommend flying or taking subways. And there could be a shakeup at the Supreme Court. It's being widely reported today that Justice Souter will step down in June. Justice Souter hasn't been shy about his disdain and distaste for Washington politics. He was appointed by the first Bush president, but he faced pressure to not step down while until George W. Bush was out of office. Daljit.
The White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs says that the president is extending billions more in government loans to Chrysler, even though all the stakeholders aren't on board with the restructuring.
Would we like to have announced an agreement with 100% of those stakeholders rather than some vast, vast majority? Sure, but the president believes that we have a good agreement.
And Chrysler heads to its first bankruptcy court hearing today. In Iraq, three American servicemen were killed west of Baghdad yesterday. Military officials say that two Marines and a sailor died in combat. And that brings the death toll for April for American servicemen in Iraq to 18.
On Wall Street, the Dow and S&P were flat yesterday. The Dow opens this hour at 81.68. The S&P starts trading at 873. It's being widely reported that Supreme Court Justice David Souter is planning to retire in June after more than 18 years on the court. And we want to know, who do you think President Obama should nominate to take his place?
He's going to replace her with a woman, a liberal woman, and probably a minority woman. Sounds like Oprah Winfrey to me. But ironically, his own wife would actually fit the bill.
Your pick. You want to know what your pick is? You can call us on 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
All right, so we've got Michelle Obama. We've got
Jerry Springer.
Jerry Springer. Oprah Winfrey was mentioned.
Didn't Elliot Spitzer come up?
Elliot Spitzer
Somebody said he would be spicy. That's for sure, right?
That's right. Elliot Spitzer might have come up. We've had somebody suggested Diana Ross from the Supremes. I think Femi might have mentioned that in the newsroom this morning.
Yeah, and somebody impersonating the Godfather with a lot of cotton wool in his mouth.
All right. Well, tell us what you think. MyTakeAtTheTakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Daljit Dhaliwal here with Todd Zwillick. Good morning.
Good morning, Daljit.
Well, it has been widely reported this morning that Justice David Souter is expected to retire from the Supreme Court in June after almost two decades on the court. So we're asking you, who do you think President Obama should nominate to take his place?
Hi, this is John from Kingston, New York. If I was Barack Obama, I would definitely nominate my wife, Michelle. She has a law degree. We need a woman on the bench, and it's always good to have brownie points with a wife.
That's for sure. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can also email us at mytakeatthetakeaway.org. That's mytakeatthetakeaway.org. And also tell us, what do you know about Justice Souter? A lot of people outside of the Beltway, right, Todd, don't really know that much about him.
So we
would like to get your thoughts on exactly what you know about Souter, and who do you think should also step into his place?
All right, well, we can learn a lot more about David Souter right now. He's planning to retire after nearly 19 years on the Supreme Court, giving the president, President Obama, his first chance to fill a vacancy on the High Court. Our friend Nate Persily was at the Supreme Court on Wednesday watching the proceedings. He's a professor of law and political science at Columbia here in New York City and a frequent guest on our show. And Nate, you called it, right? You wrote a dispatch after Wednesday's arguments that Souter looked like he might be leaving the court. Did you see it in his eyes?
Actually, he seemed particularly frustrated by that argument. This was a constitutional challenge to the Voting Rights Act, a very big case. And you got the sense that he was regretting that this was the parting blow, that this was going to be the case that he was going to have to leave on, and he was going to have to write a dissent in this case. And it sort of was emblematic to him about the rightward shift in the court.
All right. So for people who haven't followed the court very closely, probably haven't heard much about the court, what role did Souter play? He wasn't frequently a swing vote. What was his primary role there?
Well, Justice Souter is the most recent in a long line of Republican appointees who then surprised their appointers by being liberal. And so he frequently joined the three other more liberal justices on the court to form a four-justice dissenting bloc, I guess the way to put it. The most salient issue that came before him in his early years was obviously these abortion cases, where he surprised many by upholding the core aspects of Roe versus Wade. He did join conservatives in saying that the government doesn't need to fund abortions. But for the most part, on issues of civil rights, on issues of equal protection, voting rights, other things, that he was pretty solidly with the liberal box.
And wound up being infuriating to the right on that basis, because some people saw him as a turncoat. Even though Supreme Court justices by definition are supposed to be immunized from this kind of politics, he was seen as a turncoat by many of the right. And some people, at least that I've talked to, believe that that was part of what was behind the reaction to appoint such conservatives later, to make sure that it was somebody who was going to stick to the line and not give any surprises, people like Roberts and Alito.
No, I think that's definitely right. And I think that, you know, Souter has become a symbol of what happens when a president doesn't vet a justice sufficiently, and that there's a chance that they could significantly change from what was expected.
All right. Well, most people don't follow the court too terribly closely, but we have a piece of sound here from David Souter that most people will probably recognize, even if they don't follow the court all that closely.
There is no genuinely subjective indication beyond what can be viewed as either a dimple or a hanging chad, and there is a general rule being applied in a given county that an objective intent or an intent on an objective standard will be inferred. And that objective rule varies, we're told, from county to county.
Dimples and hanging chads, Bush v. Gore.
That's right. He was one of the dissenters in Bush versus Gore, and his dissent actually emphasized that the court never should have gotten involved at all in the controversy, that it was something that, you know, threatened the impartiality of the judiciary and was the kind of thing that the political branches should solve.
All right. So Souter is a liberal, what's branded a liberal. Ostensibly, Barack Obama would want to name somebody of like ideological thinking. So we're not likely to see any major ideological shift on the court. Is this block likely to stay the same? Let me ask it this way. What prevents Barack Obama from falling into the same trap that George H.W. Bush did when he appointed Souter and wound up with somebody who voted against his ideology most of the time?
There's always a chance that a justice will evolve over time on the Supreme Court, but I think Barack Obama, a constitutional law professor, is very well acquainted with the nominees that he might be putting forward, and I think that's unlikely.
You got any names for us, potential replacements?
Well, all the names that are being kicked around are the ones that the people are thinking about. Elena Kagan, who's the Solicitor General, former Dean of Harvard Law School. Kathleen Sullivan, former Dean of Stanford Law School. Diane Wood on the Seventh Circuit. Sonia Sotomayor on the Second Circuit are all names that people are pointing to.
A lot of women this time around. I mean, what do some of them bring to the table? Anything jump out at you in particular?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised, for example, if he chooses someone who is not a judge right now. That might be a sort of significant move for him. So that's why the deans of the law schools are possibilities. Some people mentioned Deval Patrick, the governor of Massachusetts, who also was attorney in the Civil Rights Division, led the Civil Rights Division under President Clinton. Each one of them has a track record of supporting particular, I wouldn't call them liberals, I mean, because there isn't, in the historic sense, there aren't even really true liberals on the court of the nature of Earl Warren or Justice Brennan or Justice Marshall, but they are certainly more to the left than the conservative members there. And, I think that each one of them is a pretty predictable vote to go with the four more liberal justices.
All right. Well, around where I work on Capitol Hill, nobody can seem to look beyond, forget the Beltway, they can't even look beyond the Hill itself, and people throw around the name of Senator Dianne Feinstein, member of the Judiciary Committee from California.
That's a possibility, but I think that I would think that's unlikely. And remember, one of the other questions is how old they are, right? I mean, he wants to appoint someone who's relatively young so that that life appointment really means something.
All right, so you said that you said a justice can evolve, and certainly Souter evolved. That's a nice way of saying turncoat, somebody on the right might say.
Oh, they're entitled to change
sure.
their mind.
Of course
I mean,
they
really do evolve.
And that's the question I have. How and why? Has there ever been any indication of his evolution, why he changed, or was he hiding his true opinions when he was in confirmation hearings?
It's a little bit of both. I think that he was hiding some of, I don't know about sort of actively hiding, but he was a stealth justice. People knew very little about him. It made him confirmable, and that's why George Bush the First wanted him as the nominee.
And how do you think that this is going to play outside of the Beltway? I mean, is this a story that sort of the average American is likely to follow? Do they care? Is it something that sort of that they would be concerned about right now?
Supreme Court battles are less about the individual person, although sometimes with Judge Bork or Justice Thomas they could be, than they are about the salience they bring to the issues that the courts decide, particularly abortion, issues dealing with race, other kinds of civil rights issues. And that's what happens when you have these fights over Supreme Court nominations. It focuses people on those constitutional issues. Gay rights is also another area.
All right. Well, we've been asking listeners about who they think should be next on the court. There's an opening, and our listeners have been weighing in on this. So listen to this.
Hi, my name is Laura. I'm calling from New York. I am just thrilled that Obama is the one that's picking the new Supreme Court justice and not John McCain, which would have changed a lot in America. I trust his choice.
All right, indeed. But not a surprise that Obama's going to get at least one pick, and they expect him probably to get more.
Yeah,
you're flashing three.
I think it's likely that he's going to get three picks. I mean, I think Justice Ginsburg and Justice Stevens are likely to retire in the next 3 years, at least those two.
All right, so what's coming up this summer then, or at some point, if Justice Souter retires in June, as is being widely reported, is a confirmation hearing, a confirmation process in the Senate. Democrats are close to that magical 60 vote number because Arlen Specter, who's former chairman of Judiciary, is switching to the Democratic side. Even if the Democrats do have 60, there has not been a Supreme Court nomination process in many years that hasn't been a big red meat, politically divisive issue. Think of things like the nuclear option, parties going to the mat over this stuff. Is that still likely to happen even if there are 60 votes on Obama's side?
Well, it depends who he nominates. I mean, I think that the likelihood that the Republicans will try to obstruct or try to vote against a nominee depends on how liberal that person is.
But they also raise a lot of money off of it. Forget about the votes. They can get their base ginned up over it.
Well, that's right. I mean, this is an opportunity to take a stand on all the kinds of moral values issues that have often divided the parties and are electorally significant.
All right. Nate Persily is Supreme Court watcher and a Supreme Court expert. He's also professor of law and political science at Columbia University. He's a frequent guest here at The Takeaway. Well, Justice Souter is apparently, reportedly, on his way out, and we want to know who you think should be his replacement. 8778-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org is the email address. It doesn't have to be a circuit court judge. It doesn't have to be a lawyer. It can be anyone who you think should be on the court.
And we've had some very interesting responses to our question. Who have we had? We've had somebody pretending to be the Godfather. We've had somebody saying that Jerry Springer should do it.
Right. We've actually gotten a couple of emails on this. Eric from Pontiac, Michigan says Jennifer Granholm, of course. She's a governor of Michigan. And here's Paul, Judge Judy. Lots of choices.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Todd Zwillick, Dolly Daljeet Dhaliwal is here with me on The Takeaway. Sorry about that. It's being widely reported this morning that Supreme Court Justice David Souter is planning to retire in June after more than 18 years on the court. And we're asking you, who do you think President Obama should nominate to take his place?
Paul from Queens, New York. How about Bill Bradley for Supreme Court Justice?
Hi, this is Michael from Brooklyn. What about Mary Cheney for the Supreme Court? I think lesbians need representation.
Okay. Mary Cheney, Dick Cheney's daughter. And we've received an email from Jeff in Manhattan. He says, given the celebritization of politics, I guess we should tap Diana Ross. So we should have Diana Ross and the Supreme's Court. Get it? The Supremes.
We had that earlier.
Femi thought so too. Tell us your pick at 8778-MY-TAKE. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Dalji.
Now, most, if not all of us, wonder what can be done to reduce the mitigating, or at least mitigate the harmful effects of climate change. Well, a team of scientists in California has a shovel-ready idea, which, while it may not be entirely new, it does sound easy, it's not expensive, and they think that it's high time that the Obama administration should begin to back this idea on a large scale. The idea involves a lot of paint. The plan is to lighten up our rooftops and other dark surfaces, which absorb energy, to make them more reflective. And whether this, to explain this idea is Surabhi Menon. She's a research scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in Berkeley, California. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What does painting your roof white have to do with global warming?
Well, the levels of CO2 we are at right now, 385 to 390 parts per million, is considered now to be as dangerous as going to 450 parts per million, which was the 2-degree threshold at which the consequences would be more dramatic than we warned.
But what does painting your roof white do with it?
So we then go to the alternate clean energy carbon sequestration, and all that takes some more time. So we have, in the meantime, we keep warming since CO2 emissions have not declined. So you begin to look at alternatives, measures that could counteract some of the warming that masks carbon dioxide effects, which would buy us some time to reduce CO2 impacts, and modifying urban albedos is one of them. So what it means...
What's that, an albedo?
It's changing the albedo of urban areas. So what it means is, if we were to make all the rooftops and paved surfaces more reflective, more white, have aggregates which are light or cool color pigments, then we would reflect some of the solar radiation coming in, much like clouds do, and then we would not warm the surface as much.
So basically, the heat is bounced off out of the Earth's atmosphere, and does it lessen or stop greenhouse gases from forming if we end up...
It just reduces the warming that would take place if the radiation were allowed to reach the surface, and you would have the extra warming that would take place.
Well, you know, it sounds a little drastic, though, doesn't it, painting all of the world's surfaces light colors?
It's been done in a lot of tropical countries for ages, and so this is one of the measures. We have been creating these urban surfaces, urban areas, so if we were to take measures that would then retrofit or revamp when things need to be maintained again, if you just make them light colored, then you would be able to reflect some of the energy. And also what it does is it reduces energy costs, because you would use that for air conditioning. So it reduces mm-hmm. some of the fossil right. fuels you would use. So there are two benefits to it.
And you actually did some solid research on this. Can you tell us a little bit, just very briefly, about what hard evidence you have to support this?
Well, in our paper with Dr. Akberi at Lawrence Berkeley and Commissioner Rosenfeld from the California Energy Commission, we calculated if we increased all urban areas to make them more reflective, we would offset about 60 to 70 gigatons of CO2 per year. And if you think that right now we're emitting about 8 to 16 gigatons of CO2, what this urban albedo program, which increasing the reflectivity of urban areas, what it would do is buy us a few years. And the evidence that exists is, if you look at land albedo changes, there's been some studies in Spain where they looked at increased green horticulture, where you have vegetation which is different than the surrounding land, and they actually can quantify a temperature decrease because of changing the albedo.
Surabhi, this is Todd Zwillick. You mentioned that reflecting that energy would help in the summertime because it would lead to probably lower air conditioning costs and fuel consumption. But what about in the winter? I thought one of the points of rooftop installations in some cases was to absorb solar energy so that you use less heating in the winter in colder climates. Wouldn't it defeat that purpose?
Yes. So in colder climates, it's not going to be as effective. You do not get the energy savings as much as you would in warmer climates.
Mostly for the tropics then?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And what are you planning on doing with this idea? I mean, it's not something that's new, of course. I mean, you know, if you look in warm climates, if you go to Spain, places like Greece, a lot of the houses there are painted mm-hmm. entirely white, not just the rooftops. But right. you're planning on getting the energy department to do something concrete with this idea. I mean, it wasn't...
Yeah, I mean, we have standards for rooftops, which have the Energy Star labeling, so you could have them be more reflective when you have new roofs put in. So California has been leading some of that, but there is no strong policy on paved surfaces. And so it's going to be a little bit difficult to implement something like that.
And any idea what the carbon footprint would be for such a large-scale paint job?
Oh, you mean just painting?
Yes.
The costs are going to be higher at the beginning, but then you save things later on, as usual.
And just very briefly, you've also said that volcanic eruptions cool the Earth. I mean, short of creating a fake eruption, how would this work? How credible is it? Does it cause pollution? What's the science on this?
Yeah, with the geoengineering schemes, now this may be considered as one of the geoengineering schemes. With volcanic eruptions, you get the benefit of... worldwide temperatures dropping down like we saw with Mount Pinatubo in 1991. But the consequences can be pretty dramatic if you release these stratosphere all these sulfate particles. With the urban albedo, you're not really doing too much of geoengineering. You're just making things more reflective. And that's a pretty basic concept. So I don't think it's as dangerous as the other measures being considered.
Surabhi Menon, a research scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in Berkeley, California. Thank you so much for joining us.
So Justice Souter looks likely to retire, and we want to know, who do you think President Obama should nominate to take his place?
Hi, Larry from Detroit. All the justices should be replaced. They should serve a term similar to elected. Without being elected, the ages of things they're allowed to remain on the court for are just too long.
Might be poetic justice if President Obama nominated Al Gore to the Supreme Court, wouldn't it? After Bush v. Gore?
There's a thought.
How about that? Well, tell us your pick at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We want to know who you think should be the next Supreme Court justice. That Al Gore idea, by the way, wasn't mine. It wasn't an original. We got an email from a listener.
You did?
I don't want to take credit for it, but anyway, keep the emails coming. mytake@thetakeaway.org. Let us know who you think should be on the court. Who's your pick?
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Daljit Dhaliwal. Let's get you caught up on the news headlines now. And Femi Okeh is back with us. Hello.
Hello there, Daljit. 32 minutes past the hour. We are getting news in this morning that H1N1, or swine flu, has reached China. Hong Kong's leader says that there's a case there, and that would be the first confirmed case in that part of the world. The patient is a Mexican citizen, now isolated in a hospital. There are multiple reports this morning that Supreme Court Justice David Souter is ready to step down. This would open up a slot on the court's liberal wing. Souter and three other current justices reliably vote together. And he's made no secret of his distaste for officialdom in Washington. And speculation about him peaked when he hadn't hired new staffers for the coming term. A Japanese company is taking over Citigroup's brokerage business in Japan. Sumitomo Mitsui will take it off Citi's hands for more than $5 billion. And this is a long-expected deal, part of plans to restructure the ailing mega bank Citigroup. Staying overseas in Sri Lanka, the government is urging civilians in the war zone to actually get out as soon as possible. The military has Tamil rebels cornered in a small area in the country's north. There's international pressure for a ceasefire to protect tens of thousands of civilians in that area. As to look at some of the big stories domestically and internationally, Daljit, Todd, back to you.
Thank you very much, Femi. Well, as Femi has been saying, Mexican officials announced a shutdown of the country in response to the flu outbreak, H1N1, of course better known as the swine flu. Offices, restaurants, schools and soccer stadiums will be closed from today through until Tuesday. With all this news, it doesn't seem a good time to be a Mexican right now. Here's what we know right now. 2,498 suspected cases in Mexico involving pneumonia, 97 cases of swine flu that have been confirmed, 168 suspected deaths, 12 confirmed from swine flu in the United States. And joining us from Orange County, California is Gustavo Arellano. He writes a syndicated column called Ask a Mexican. Well, I'm going to ask a Mexican. What is it like to be a Mexican right now with all of this stuff going on with the so-called swine flu?
It's really tough. We were already blamed for so many of America's ills, from bad tipping to loss of jobs and the downfall of the economy. Now we're seen as this huge pathogen come to life, ready to infect the nostrils and lungs of all Americans. It's really sad. So we'll just drink more tequila this Cinco de Mayo.
Well, how are most Mexicans reacting to this? I mean, when you speak to the average Mexican, I mean, do they just feel that they're just really getting the short end of the stick and it's playing into these being typecast and stereotyped all over again?
It's been a tough year in Mexico, not just because, you know, we started off with the narco war and, of course, all the subsequent media attention and travel warnings to Mexico. And now you have this swine flu that everyone is blaming on Mexico as if somehow we created this because of our supposedly unhygienic ways. It's going to be devastating for the Mexican economy because we're so dependent, Mexico's so dependent on tourism. But then Mexicans here in the United States, now you're seeing a lot of rhetoric from nativist groups saying that you should avoid Mexicans at all costs because we're likely carriers of the disease. Never mind that most of the people most of the Americans who first contracted swine flu got it in Mexico and then flew legally here to the United States, back to their home countries.
And how does this play into the wider issues around immigration, tighter border controls, so on and so forth?
Well, now you have a continued and much more heated call to close down the borders immediately, as if somehow if you shut down any entry of Mexicans into the United States, that's somehow going to either contain or isolate the swine flu. And President Barack Obama himself has said that's just not feasible, considering so much of the economy, especially in the U.S.-Mexico border on our side, is dependent on constant to and fro from the United States. Mexico.
Right. And Gustav, as you know, there's been a lot of discussion going on about what this should be called. There have also been some reports of attempts to label this the Mexican flu. Has President Felipe Calderón addressed this at all?
He hasn't, though a lot of Mexican consuls in the United States, they have, and they think they say that to call it the Mexican flu, it's a bit racist. I wouldn't go so far as to call it racist. It's very easy for Americans, and I guess people in general, they want something that's easier to say and easier to pinpoint when it comes to endemics or pandemics. As in 1918, of course, the most famous example, the Spanish flu was not created in Spain. Then Spain didn't even have the most amount of victims. That's just where the American media happened to have been when they started noticing that a lot of people were getting killed from it. It's similarly with Mexico. Yeah, Mexico might turn out to be the first place the place that created the swine flu, but to call it the Mexican flu, that's just silly.
But when you think back to the SARS outbreak and you compare the so-called swine flu, and that's also something that originated in a different continent. Do sort of comparisons come to mind about how that was treated and how that was reported and whether these sorts of stereotypes and typecasting came out into the open?
When it comes to Mexicans in the United States, anything dealing with pathology, Mexicans are always going to get the worst brunt of it. Mexicans and Muslims. Of course, there were stereotypes when there was the avian flu, the vague stereotypes of, oh, those Chinese, they'll eat anything. Therefore, there must have been some virus that jumped from, I don't know, an ocelot or some strange animal into the human system and then went on to infect everyone. But China and Asia and Hong Kong, wherever that flu came from, it's far away. It needs an airplane flight. Mexico Mexico is right there on the United States border, an ever-looming menace to American society. Therefore, the stereotypes and also just the hysteria surrounding anything that comes from Mexico is just going to be more outrageous and sillier than any other country around.
Is there something that you think that Mexicans, especially American Mexicans, need to be doing to protect themselves? I mean, it sounds like a dreadful situation. I mean, are people are fearful in their communities?
The only thing we can do at this point is to eat a lot of pozole, which is this rich red hominy stew, put a lot of jalapenos in it, and really drink a lot of orange juice. That's always worked for me to stave off any sickness. And, hey, I'm the healthiest man in the world.
Yeah, Gustavo, you could also wash your hands thoroughly, right, and not go out if you're sick.
No, whatever.
I'm sorry. It's important, and it's important for everyone. I know we're talking about the cultural aspects of this. Everyone can do that as well. And it would be empowering to the Mexican-American community to everyone get into hand-washing together, don't you think?
Yeah, because we've never done that before.
No, that's not what I'm saying. You've never done it before. It's important for everyone.
Well, of course, but that goes without saying. You see,
but it doesn't go without saying. That's the problem.
Common sense things like that. You don't need to say that. If you do need to say that, that just shows that you're not doing it already, and that's the problem. That some people think, oh, Mexicans are already somehow unhygienic. Therefore, hey, you know, it's all their fault. In fact, I'm as we speak, I'm going through these blogs of right wing people saying avoid all restaurants now because most of them employoy legal aliens, and of course we know how in Mexico people do not wash their hands. That's just silly.
It is silly.
Well, it certainly got the bloggers talking. It certainly got us talking, and it's an interesting angle to explore. Gustavo Arellano, he writes a syndicated column for Ask a Mexican. Thank you very much for joining us.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, it's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Daljit Dhaliwal. Chrysler is getting yet another chance to rewrite its business plan and reorganize, but now it will be done with the help of Fiat, an Italian car maker famous for zippy car culture that has little in common with Detroit V8 engines. And with us is Nelson Schwartz. He's a European economics correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So Chrysler gets an Italian accent. What's life going to be like under Fiat?
Well, it's quite a different corporate culture. Fiat, you know, it was remembered in the United States for, you know, the nickname was Fix It Again Tony, and the car seemed to spend more time in the garage than on the road. Fiat's changed, though, quite a bit in the last 5 years. It was actually near bankruptcy itself 5 years ago, but they got a new chief executive, Sergio Marchionne, who's really turned things around, put much, much more emphasis on quality, on speed, on delivering results for managers in the past at Fiat.
Has he spoken directly about this particular merger?
In terms of this merger, he's, you know, come out and, you know, really pushed hard for it. I mean, he says it's his, you know, first priority is making this work, and basically they want to, you know, import the Fiat technology, where they've really made progress in terms of smaller cars and fuel-efficient cars, and kind of enable Chrysler to have decent small to medium-sized cars, which they really don't have right now. I mean, they have some models, but Chrysler's really dependent on trucks and SUVs, which, as we know, are not selling. Fiat's stronger at that.
Right. Well, how viable a partnership do you think this is going to be? I mean, other partnerships with European automakers like Daimler, you know, ended in tears, quite frankly.
Yep.
You know, why do we think that Fiat is going to work for American workers?
Well, it's quite difficult. There are a couple of things in Fiat's favor, namely $6-7 billion in U.S. government aid is going to pour into Chrysler. to sort of help retool the factories and, you know, get Chrysler through this period where it's burning cash. The big problem is, will they burn more cash than they expect to now, and where will they need more, and where will that come from? Because Fiat has said they don't want to invest more cash to make this possible at this point. It's a big challenge. There's no question about it. On the other hand, the concessions made by the union are fairly significant, and Marchionne did a very, very good job at turning Fiat around from its own quality and sales problems.
Do you see other car companies following suit here in terms of what Chrysler's going through in the bankruptcy courts, the whole idea of more acquisitions, more mergers, more alliances?
Well, Marchionne has said that the auto industry right now has too much capacity. It's basically they can make way, way too many cars than there are buyers. So capacity has to be removed. That would suggest the number of players is going to be reduced. It's consolidation. Bankruptcy, I mean, General Motors would be the next up. I think there was more of an acceptance in the United States, say, that Chrysler could be let go in terms of bankruptcy. I think politically letting General Motors go into bankruptcy is more difficult. In fact, in terms of international partnerships, Fiat is also eyeing the Latin American and European operations of General Motors. So that's another kind of merger consolidation. But there's no question that there's capacity has to be removed.
All right, Nelson Schwartz, thank you very much. Got to leave it there.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Daljit Dhaliwal. Good morning, everyone. It looks like a Justice Souter is planning to retire from the Supreme Court, and we have been asking you, who do you think President Obama should nominate to take his place? One listener responded to one of my comments.
Todd Zwillig said something that just made me laugh in derision about who Obama should appoint or would represent our views. I happen to be pro-life, and I know that the chance of even considering someone from that side of the spectrum is about as likely as pigs flying.
Well, another of you thought that it's not that far off, in fact.
Catherine from Manhattan. Who said pigs can't fly? Swine flu.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. What, did you like that, Femi? That was kind of nice little play on words.
It was
pig flies, swine flu.
Actually, far too clever for us, and we're not worthy. I'm scared every day. I open the microphone.
All right, give us the headlines then.
Good morning, everybody. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Hong Kong has confirmed the first case of H1N1 swine flu in China. Hong Kong's leader says that the patient is a Mexican citizen who developed a fever after arriving in Hong Kong. The patient had also travelled to Shanghai. 10 Pakistani security officials apparently kidnapped by Taliban militants are now free. The men were taken in a northwest border region where Pakistan has launched an attack against militants. US scientists are taking an emergency step to stop a mysterious fungus that they blame for killing 500,000 wild animals. The US Forest Service is closing thousands of caves and inactive mines for a year to protect endangered bats. The animals have died in droves. They've been killed by white nose syndrome. And scientists aren't sure, but they think people are spreading the fungus when they actually explore the bat caves, and the disease doesn't actually threaten humans. And finally, in sports, the defending NBA champion Boston Celtics have been pushed to a deciding seventh game in their first round playoff series with the Chicago Bulls. Chicago tied it 3-3 last night, and oh, I can't resist it. Kentucky Derby coming up for the weekend. And,
have you got your floppy hat?
Oh, no, I don't have my floppy hat, but I will bring you the results coming up in a forthcoming
forecast.
All right. Thanks, Femi. Well, H1N1 has been in the headlines, and so is Arlen Specter, switching from Democratic to Republican. But that's not all the news that's fit to print, not even close. There are a lot of stories that didn't even get in the news this week. Did you know that the Obama administration is sticking to a state secrets claim on some key detainee civil rights cases? The Senate is kowtowing to bankers on mortgage and bankruptcy. If you didn't hear those stories, we're going to talk to Mark Jerkowitz. He's Associate Director of the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism. And joining us also to talk about the stories that should have made the headlines this week is Salon columnist Glenn Greenwald. Mark, let me start with you. What news did we miss because of the big headlines?
Well, interestingly enough, what might have happened and the tendency that we tend to see in our evaluation of news coverage is that some of the big headlines of this week probably were a little smaller than they would have otherwise been, frankly, because of the swine flu. We have something called the News Coverage Index, and we measure basically what stories are being produced by the mainstream media, and I should argue say that this is the mainstream media, on a weekly basis. And while our week is still going on, it's clear this week that the predominant story by far has been the swine flu crisis.
Right.
What's gotten secondary coverage? The stories you just mentioned. The Arlen Specter defection to the Democratic Party. To some degree, the focus on the first 100 days of the Obama administration, which some can argue is a hallmark holiday and some consider to be important. The troubled economy, the situation with Chrysler. These are all stories that have trailed the swine flu significantly. And based on the trends that we have seen in news coverage in recent years, the bigger likelihood, had there been no swine flu story to cover this week, is that stories like Obama's first 100 days or Specter's defection or the Chrysler story would have actually been bigger. So, my hypothesis would be that these second, third, and fourth stories would have actually sucked more of the oxygen out of the room.
Would have been bigger. Well, Glenn Greenwald from Salon.com, you think that we in the media or the mainstream media like to chase other kinds of stories like the Craigslist killer and sort of more sensationalistic stories. Do you think without H1N1 that the situation would have been any different this week in terms of coverage?
I think yes and no. I think certainly if there weren't these obsessions with stories that are very melodramatic, that get the fear levels high and pumping, that there would be opportunities to cover more substantive and truly consequential stories. At the same time, the two stories that you identified at the beginning as ones that didn't really receive any sort of attention, namely the fact that Obama is embracing many of the most radical Bush theories of shielding presidential actions from any sort of legal scrutiny or judicial review, and the fact that the Senate essentially is controlled by the bankers, by the banking industry that spawned the financial crisis, and that's not me saying that the number two senator in the United States Senate, Dick Durbin, said, quote, this place is owned by the bankers. Those are the kinds of stories that I think mainstream media tends to avoid in the first case, because things like constitutional rights and abuses of government power are things that are complicated and not particularly interesting to most media stars. And I think the second, that the U.S. Congress is controlled by the people who pour money into their coffers, that it's literally an intrinsically corrupt institution, is something that people in the media simply don't believe and consider to be so normalized that it's not really worth reporting.
Right. Well, Mark, it's been a big, interesting, harried week for news, H1N1, Arlen Specter, Obama's first 100 days. So it has been a big news week with lots of important stories. Certainly swine flu is incredibly important. But a few weeks ago, I remember stories, everybody obsessing over the Obama's dog, right? And mm-hmm. those stories that do make it to the top of the headlines. They're fun and they're cute and fuzzy, just like the dogs. The stories are too. But what consequence to stories like that have? Is it all obfuscation and marketing by the White House? What does it do to us as news consumers when stories like that rise to the top of the headlines?
Well, we have to put Bo in a little bit of perspective, which is that Bo did get a lot of coverage, and there are a lot of tabloid editors and editors elsewhere who would tell you can never go wrong putting an animal on page one. It did not dominate the news agenda the week that the Bo story came out. And, there are a lot of definitions of news, and not all of them have to be eating our vegetables. I'm all for covering the most significant things that can conceivably have the most impact on the most people and that people should know about. And so Bo becomes nothing more than a sideshow, obviously. But it did not dominate the news cycle. One story I think that did dominate the news cycle in a couple of recent weeks that's worth talking about in that light is sort of the Somali pirate story,
right?
Which sort of sprung from nowhere. Of all the foreign policy crises that the president was supposed to be facing, this was not one that was anticipated. And for 2 weeks in a row, that was a dominant story. Now, obviously, there was a dramatic event that included the rescue of Captain Phillips. But, you know, there's a lot of argument that, you know, there's something sort of subliminally voyeuristic about the idea of pirates and high seas thievery. And there's a legitimate question there, frankly, about was the threat, you know, is the threat really overblown? Is this really a huge foreign policy crisis? But that's the kind of story that had a lot of sort of diverse elements in it, including conflict and drama, that really did dominate the news cycle for a couple of weeks. So I think you could make an argument about just how significant a story it was.
And one of the really important aspects of that story, of course, is that the Somalia as a failed state. I mean, that had sort of crept into the news agenda with some news outlets looking at that, and then it kind of went away again, and nobody wanted to talk about what's happening in the Horn of Africa.
That's exactly. I mean, that story quickly became. I mean, it took two forms. One was sort of the human interest story, that was very obviously U.S. centric about the captain and the crew. And the other was sort of, well, what do we do next? You know, then it suddenly became is this a geopolitical threat? How do we get these guys? Do we hit them at their base in Somalia? But there was very little coverage about sort of the root cause of that. I would agree on that.
All right. Well, Glenn, let me bring you in here real quickly, just because we're going to wrap pretty soon. I want to ask you about H1N1 and the way it's been covered. It's obviously a big story verging on a pandemic. It's obviously going to make news. What do you make of the quality of the coverage to stop flu? Of course, if people do basic things like wash their hands, stay home if they're sick, we can head off these infections and epidemics. Has the media conveyed that accurately, or have they been too sensationalistic? What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. It's a story. I think that there's no perspective on it, though. And what happens is that it ends up being distorted given how much attention is paid. I mean, there's no question that it has the potential to be a serious pandemic. At the same time, most of these types of medical issues where diseases spread slowly, the way it's spreading slowly, end up being very mild, and the implications and consequences limited.
All right. I'd like to thank my guest, Glenn Greenwald, a columnist for Salon Magazine, and Mark Jerkowitz, Associate Director of the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism.
And this morning we have been reporting that Supreme Court Justice David Souter is planning to retire in June after more than 18 years on the court. And we've been asking you, who do you think that President Obama should nominate to take his place?
And I would nominate Jerry Springer.
Elliot Spitzer.
What about Mary Cheney for the Supreme Court? I think lesbians need representation.
Ted Shaw, lead attorney for the NAACP.
Former New Jersey Governor Christy Whitman.
Judith Kaye.
I'm Todd Zwillick.
I'm Daljit Dhaliwal.
It's The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.